Today's reading is from Joel chapter 2, verses 18 to 27. Then the Lord became jealous for his land and had pity on his people. The Lord answered and said to his people, "Behold, I am sending to you grain, wine, and oil, and you will be satisfied. And I will no more make you a reproach among the nations. I will remove the northerner far from you and drive him into a parched and desolate land, his vanguard into the eastern sea and his rearguard into the western sea. The stench and foul smell of him will rise, for he has done great things. Fear not, O land. Be glad and rejoice, for the Lord has done great things. Fear not, you beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness are green. The tree bears its fruit. The fig tree and vine give their full yield. Be glad, O children of Zion, and rejoice in the Lord your God, for he has given the early rain for your vindication. He has poured down for you abundant rain, the early and the latter rain, as before. The threshing floors shall be full of grain. The vats shall overflow with wine and oil. I will restore to you the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter, my great army, which I sent among you. You shall eat in plenty and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. And my people shall never again be put to shame. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and there is none else. And my people shall never again be put to shame."
Well, it's dramatic stuff, isn't it? I wonder if you've ever thought this. Is it worth the cost of following God? Is it worth the cost of following God? Perhaps you've wondered that in those times when life seems perfectly comfortable without him. There's a cost involved in submitting your life to someone. Is it worth it? Or when our life seems to have been laid waste, when everything that gave us joy seems to have been stripped away, or when everything seems in a muddle, is it worth sticking with God to keep following him? Or when we've given up hope, when we're just tired and it all seems too much, isn't it easier without him? Well, that's the question we're going to be exploring together today from the book of Joel in the Old Testament. If you were here last week, Ed described for us the context that Joel was speaking into, and it was centered around this terrifying plague of locusts. So chapter 1, verse 4 said this: "What the cutting locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the hopping locust has eaten. And what the hopping locust left, the destroying locust has eaten." Or Joel described in 1, verse 6, how these locusts were powerful and beyond number. And having seen that video just now, perhaps you can get a bit of a sense of what he was talking about. And the effect was devastating. So chapter 1, verse 7, "It has laid waste my vine and splintered my fig tree. It has stripped off their bark and thrown it down. Their branches are made white." Or 1, verse 10, "The fields are destroyed. The ground mourns because the grain is destroyed. The wine dries up. The oil languishes." And it's a picture of such misery and desperation. All is bare. All is empty. And the language is of mourning. 1 verse 9 to 10 says mourning, or 2 verse 6, anguish. It was such an utterly terrifying day for God's people Israel then. But it also served as a visual aid of an even more terrifying day of the Lord that's coming. So 2 verse 1 talks about that, a day of final judgment when all will be held account before the throne of God. And a day that will make this plague of locusts pale into comparison. Look at chapter 2, verse 11. For the day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? And yet it didn't end there. Last week, in the midst of this apparent hopelessness, we were given a glorious insight into God's character. So 2, verse 13. He called them back. He said, return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. And he relents over disaster. Our passage today, 2 verse 18, describes his pity, or how he's jealous for his land. And we see that in the New Testament too, don't we? In 2 Peter chapter 3 verse 9, Peter describes how the Lord is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. You see that same character of God in the New Testament as you do here in the Old Testament in Joel. God doesn't delight in the death of the wicked. He has sent Joel to them out of mercy to call them to repentance while there's still an opportunity. So that's where we left off last week with this call to repentance. 2 verse 12 said, yet even now declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping and with mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments. That was the cry, return to the Lord. He is gracious and merciful. Who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him. The situation may have looked bleak. But as long as they remembered the character of God, then they were not without hope. But as we asked earlier, is it worth it? Is repentance worth it? The passage we're looking at today, which is 2 verses 18 to 27, is Joel's attempt to persuade us, persuade the people of Israel, certainly, that yes, it absolutely is worth it. And to do that, he starts by giving them this glorious promise of restoration. So that's our first point, the promise of restoration. It's a promise of complete reversal. So where there was emptiness and barrenness, now there is fullness and plenty. So have a look at verses 18 and 19 of chapter 2. Then the Lord became jealous for his land and had pity on his people. The Lord answered and said to his people, behold, I am sending to you grain, wine, and oil, and you will be satisfied. Back in chapter 1, verse 10, we heard the grain is destroyed, that the wine dries up, the oil languishes. But now God is sending them grain, wine, and oil, more than enough, so that they are satisfied. We'll look down at verse 22. The pasture of the wilderness are green. The tree bears its fruit. The fig tree and vine give their full yield. Verse 23. God has given the early rain for your vindication. He has poured down for you abundant rain, the early and the latter rain as before. The threshing floors shall be full of grain. The vats shall overflow with wine and oil. It's a complete reversal of fortunes, where before the trees were stripped bare and the wine and oil were gone, now the picture is of abundance and plenty and overflowing. And if you watched Eurovision last night, perhaps you got a bit of a feel for what a reversal of fortune feels like. from nil point to second place feels great. What I love about some of these Old Testament prophets is it's not just like a download of information. It's not a kind of a lecture. Joel is really painting for us a graphic picture of what it feels like. He's trying to appeal to our emotions. And so he shows us what this restoration would feel like. Verse 19, you will be satisfied. Verse 21, be glad and rejoice. Verse 22, fear not. Verse 23, be glad, O children of Zion, and rejoice in the Lord your God. Verse 26, you shall eat in plenty and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. Later he says, my people shall never again be put to shame. So the first half of Joel was full of these words like mourning and lament and be ashamed. But when they turn in repentance and experience the grace of God, the emotions are so wonderful and positive and joyful. Lately here in the UK, we've been starting to hear about this potential shortage in sunflower oil and how crisp manufacturers and others are having to scramble to find new recipes that aren't so dependent on it. But obviously for the Ukrainian people, it's far more serious than just about not being able to get their packet of Walkers. The shortage of oil reflects the fact that their very existence is on the line. Or perhaps you can try to imagine living in a city under siege by an army swarming in from the north, a situation that looks utterly beyond hope, fearing that the harvest will fail. And you can imagine then for Old Testament Israel, in a comparable situation, how it would feel to then see the storehouses full of grain, vats of wine and oil, not just well stocked, but positively overflowing. You can see why it's such a wonderful image of hope. And in verse 20, you see the reason for that. The enemy is removed far away. The threat has been completely neutralized. I'll try and resist making a joke at this point about Steve and Jackie visiting us from the north and the northerner in this verse. But there you go. Verse 25, it's so precious. Verse 25, I will restore to you the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter, my great army, which I sent among you. There is so much captured in that word restored in verse 25. The promise here isn't simply of an end to hostility, leaving them to clean up the rubble and rebuild from nothing, but a full restoration and renewed hope for the future. My people shall never again be put to shame. When we suffered a great loss, it's often that little flame of hope that is extinguished. We lose something of our ability to trust. We attempt to rebuild to some extent, but we don't grow too attached in case it's lost all over again. But that's why this promised restoration is so precious, because it's backed up by the character and purpose of God. And that takes us to our second point, the purpose of restoration. The purpose of restoration. Look with me at verse 27. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and there is none else. And my people shall never again be put to shame. It's very similar to something that occurs later in chapter 3, verse 17, where he says, you shall know that I am the Lord your God who dwells in Zion, my holy mountain. And if you studied the book of Exodus in midweek recently, it should sound very familiar, because that refrain comes again and again in Exodus. Then you will know that I am the Lord. It makes this promise that Joel is giving sound like a Exodus kind of rescue. You probably noticed right the way through our passage that God is the one who has done all this. It comes again and again. I am sending. I will do this. He has given the rain. Or verse 21, the Lord has done great things. Joel doesn't want there to be the least bit of doubt, but it is God alone who has brought about this restoration. It's not just like a random throw of the dice. You know, bad luck today, but don't worry, tomorrow is bound to be better. Verse 27 says, I am the Lord your God, and there is no one else. I am in the midst of Israel. It's so tempting, isn't it, when things go wrong, to try and find all sorts of other places to turn to find hope and find comfort. Maybe if we had a better leader, things would be better. Maybe if I wasn't alone, I'd find this easier to cope with. Maybe if I moved somewhere else or had better equipment. And all of those can be great things, good things, but they're not ultimate things. The Lord is the giver of all that is good in this passage. It's his mercy and grace poured out on his people that makes a difference as they turn to him in repentance and trust. And in some ways, that's one of the things that's easier to see in those moments of utter helplessness, like this plague of locusts described here. The small incremental changes were never going to be enough for them. They needed a miracle. And that's certainly been my own experience. It's been in those moments of utter desperation when I felt at my most isolated, or when everything else I might have been trusting in has been stripped away. That's when I've most clearly experienced God's mercy and his grace present with me, in my midst, if you like. So for me personally, I think the moment that comes to mind is after I left university. I moved to Cornwall to do a ministry trainee course there at a church in Cornwall. And I was a very, very long way away from any kind of friends or family in a tiny little rural town community. And for me, that was terrifying. But it forced me to turn to God in a way that I don't think I would have done in more comfortable or familiar circumstances. And God was so faithful. I was amazed constantly at the answers to prayer I was seeing as he helped me build new relationships with some of the locals and as I grew in my faith. And it's been so moving to hear some testimonies from some of the Ukrainian Christians of how they have been trusting in God in the midst of war. The Bible Society shared a video of how Psalm 31 has been particularly precious to many of them. And it begins like this. In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. Often it's in those moments where everything else has been stripped away that we really see who God is. When we know his presence all the more keenly in the midst of us. And that brings us to our final point, the hope of restoration. The hope of restoration. You see, there's more to this promise than simply taking away this particular plague of locusts at this particular moment in history. Israel experienced a partial fulfillment of these promises. And yet it's clear that these verses are talking about something more final, more permanent. Just as the plague of locusts itself was a picture of a more terrifying day of the Lord to come, this restoration points to a day of final restoration. So look at verse 27 again. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and there is none else. And my people shall never again be put to shame. That's a promise we're still waiting for. This partial restoration that was promised to Israel is a picture of the full and final restoration that we're waiting for in the new heavens and the new earth. When we'll see all that's wrong with the world put right. When we'll see this gladness and joy and abundance and plenty in all its fullness. When we'll see God face to face. In our midst, we have an even surer hope than Joel's first listeners. We've seen part of his promises fulfilled. So we'll hear a bit more about that from Ed next week. The next verses in chapter 2 talk about God pouring out his spirit on all flesh, which is something the apostles use as an explanation for Pentecost, as the spirit was given to the New Testament church. So having seen these promises fulfilled in part, gives us even more reason to trust that God will keep the rest of his promises in full. So why does Joel tell us all this? Why give Israel this amazing picture of restoration? And why was it recorded for us all these years later? Well, surely it's to persuade them and us that repentance is absolutely worth it. That repentance that he called Israel to last week, it's absolutely worth it. So whether life is going splendidly for you, and you're tempted to feel like you barely need God in your life, or whether all is turned to rubble around you and the fields are stripped bare, God is in our midst. God is in our midst. Somebody who knew this was a man called Horatio Spafford. Perhaps you know his most famous song, "It Is Well With My Soul." Spafford wrote that song after a string of personal tragedies. So firstly, his 4-year-old son died. Then, as he was coming to terms with that, the great Chicago fire destroyed his home and his investment properties, wiping out his finances. So to give the family space and time to recover, Spafford made plans for him, his wife, and his 4 daughters to travel to Europe and follow the evangelists Moody and Sankey on one of their preaching tours there. And boarding the ship in November 1873, a business emergency forced Spafford to remain in Chicago while the family went on ahead without him. And sadly, whilst in the mid-Atlantic, the ship collided with another ship and sank in 12 minutes with the loss of 226 of the 307 passengers and crew. Several days later, Spafford received a telegram from his wife in Wales, which read, "Saved alone." All 4 of their daughters were lost. Well, it was as Horatio Spafford sailed over the spot where their ship had sank, as he went to join his wife Anna, that he wrote his song. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." But it's particularly the 4th verse that I wanted to share, where he says this, "But Lord, 'tis for thee, for thy coming we wait. The sky, not the grave, is our goal. O trump of the angel, O voice of the Lord, blessed hope, blessed rest of my soul." Somehow, in the midst of this immense personal tragedy, God gave Spafford this incredible hope of a glorious future when all that was wrong with the world would be put right. Joel wants us to be convinced that there is coming a great and terrible day of judgment. But for those who return to God with all our heart and cast themselves on his grace and mercy, there's this incredible promise of fullness and abundance and overflowing joy, because God promises to be there in their midst. It's not a promise that all our worldly circumstances will be easy and straightforward here in this life, as Horatio Spafford well knew. But it is hope of a full and final restoration in the day of the Lord to come, when we shall never again be put to shame. Maybe you barely dare to hope that such a restoration is possible. Well, Joel would say to you, verse 21, "Fear not." Verse 26, "You shall eat in plenty and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you." And we only need to look to Jesus as the ultimate example of that reversal of fortunes. As on the Friday he was laid in the tomb, stripped naked and bare, but on the Sunday he was raised to life as proof that God is in our midst. So is it worth repenting? Is it worth carrying on following God when we're tired and weary? If we're convinced of how wonderful this restoration that God holds out to us will be, the promise of abundance, the promise of all who threaten us removed far away, the promise of shame gone, the promise of the compassionate and merciful God in our midst, then the question really becomes, is it worth missing out on all that? There is a great and terrible day of the Lord coming, but he holds out his hand to you today and says, "Return to me with all of your heart."